19. "But that girl," Horace said, "she was all right. You know she was all right when you left the house, when you saw her in the car with him. He was just giving her a lift to town. She was all right. You know she was all right." The woman sat on the edge of the bed, looking down at the child. It lay beneath the faded clean blanket, its hands upflung beside its head, as though it had died in the presence of an unbearable agony which had not had time to touch it. Its eyes were half open, the balls rolled back into the skull, so that only the white showed, in color like weak milk. Its face was still damp with perspiration, but its breathing was easier. It no longer breathed in those weak, whistling gasps as it had when Horace entered the room. On a chair beside the bed sat a tumbler half full of faintly discolored water with a spoon in it. Through the open window came the myriad noises of the square, cars, wagons, footsteps on the pavement beneath, and through it Horace could see the courthouse with men pitching dollars back and forth, between holes in the bare earth beneath the locusts and water oaks. The woman brooded above the child. Nobody wanted her out there. Elias told them and told them they must not bring women out there. And I told her before it got dark that they were not her kind of people and to get away from there. It was that fellow that brought her. He was out there on the porch with them, still drinking, because when he came in to supper, he couldn't hardly walk, even. He hadn't even tried to wash the blood off of his face. Little shirt-tail boys that think because Lee breaks the law, they can come out there and treat our house like a... Grown people are bad, but at least they take buying whiskey like buying anything else. It's the ones like him, the ones that are too young to realize that people don't break the law just for a holiday. Horace could see her clenched hands writhing in her lap. God, if I had my way, I'd hang every man that makes it or buys it or drinks it, every one of them. But why must it have been me? Us? What had I ever done to her kind? I told her to get away from there. I told her not to stay there until dark. But that fellow that brought her was getting drunk again, and him and Van picking at each other. If she just stopped running around where they had to look at her, she wouldn't stay anywhere. She'd just dash out one door, and in a minute she'd come running in from the other direction. And if he'd just let Van alone, because Van had to go back on a truck at midnight, and so Popeye would have made him behave. And Saturday night, too. And them sitting up all night drinking anyway. And I had gone through it and gone through it, and I'd tell Lita, let's get away. And he was getting nowhere. And he would have these spells like last night, and no doctor, no telephone. And then she had to come out there, after I had slaved for him, slaved for him. Motionless, her head bent and her hands still in her lap, she had that spent immobility of a chimney rising above the ruin of a house in the aftermath of a cyclone. Standing there in the corner behind the bed with that raincoat on. She was that scared when they brought the feller in, all bloody again. They laid him on the bed and Van hit him again and Lee caught Van's arm and her standing there with her eyes like the holes in one of these masks. The raincoat was hanging on the wall, and she had it on over her coat. Her dress was all folded up on the bed. They threw the fella right on top of it, blood and all, and I said, God, are you drunk too? But Lee just looked at me, and I saw that his nose was white already, like it gets when he's drunk. There wasn't any lock on the door, but I thought that pretty soon they'd have to go and see about the truck, and then I could do something. Then Lee made me go out, too, and he took the lamp out, so I had to wait until they went back to the porch before I could go back. I stood just inside the door. The fellow was snoring in the bed there, breathing hard, with his nose and mouth all battered up again, and I could hear them on the porch. Then they would be outdoors, around the house, and at the back, too, I could hear them. Then they got quiet. I stood there, against the wall. He would snore and choke and catch his breath and moan, sort of. And I would think about that girl lying there in the dark with her eyes open, listening to them, and me having to stand there waiting for them to go away so I could do something. I told her to go away. I said, "What fault is it of mine if you're not married? I don't want you here a bit more than you want to be here." I said, "I've lived my life without any help from people of your sort. What right have you got to look to me for help? Because I've done everything for him. I've been in the dirt for him. I put everything behind me, and all I asked was to be let alone." Then I heard the door open. I could tell Lee by the way he breathes. He went to the bed and said, "I want the raincoat. Sit up and take it off." And I could hear the shucks rattling while he took it off of her. Then he went out. He just got the raincoat and went out. It was Van's coat. And I have walked around that house so much at night with those men there, men living off of Lee's risk, men that wouldn't lift a finger for him if he got caught, until I could tell any of them by the way they breathed. And I could tell Popeye by the smell of that stuff on his hair. Tommy was following him. He came in the door behind Popeye and looked at me, and I could see his eyes like a cat. Then his eyes went away, and I could feel him sort of squatting against me. And we could hear Popeye over where the bed was, and that fella snoring and snoring. I could just hear little faint sounds from the shucks, so I knew it was all right yet. And in a minute, Popeye came on back, and Tommy followed him out, creeping along behind him. And I stood there until I heard them go down to the truck. Then I went to the bed. When I touched her, she began to fight. I was trying to put my hand over her mouth so she couldn't make a noise, but she didn't anyway. She just lay there thrashing about, rolling her head from one side to the other, holding to the coat. "You fool," I says, "it's me, the woman." "But that girl," Horace said, "she was all right. When you were coming back to the house the next morning after the baby's bottle, you saw her and knew she was all right." The room gave onto the square. Through the window he could see the young men pitching dollars in the courthouse yard, and the wagons passing or tethered about the hitching chains, and he could hear the footsteps and voices of people on the slow and unhurried pavement below the window, the people buying comfortable things to take home and eat at quiet tables. You know she was all right. That night Horace went out to his sister's in a hired car. He did not telephone. He found Miss Jenny in her room. "Well," she said, "Narcissa will—" "I don't want to see her," Horace said. "A nice, well-bred young man, a Virginia gentleman. I know why he didn't come back."
"Who? Gowan?"
"Yes, Gowan. And by the Lord, he'd better not come back. By God, when I think that I had the opportunity—"
"What? What did he do?"
"He carried a little fool girl out there with him that day and got drunk and ran off and left her. That's what he did. If it hadn't been for that woman, and when I think of people like that walking the earth with impunity just because he has a balloon-tailed suit and went through the astonishing experience of having attended Virginia, on any train or in any hotel, on the street, anywhere, mind you—"
"Oh,"
Miss Jenny said.
"I didn't understand at first who you meant."
"Well," he said,
"you remember that last time he was here, just after you came? The day he wouldn't stay for supper and went to Oxford?
Yes. And when I think how I could have...
He asked Narcissa to marry him. She told him that one child was enough for her.
I said she has no heart. She cannot be satisfied with less than insult.
So he got mad and said he would go to Oxford, where there was a woman he was reasonably confident he would not appear ridiculous to. Something like that. Well,
she looked at him, her neck bowed to see across her spectacles.
I'll declare, a male parent is a funny thing. But just let a man have a hand in the affairs of a female that's no kin to him. What is it that makes a man think that the female flesh he marries or begets might misbehave, but all he didn't marry or get is bound to?
Yes, Horace said, and thank God she isn't my flesh and blood. I can reconcile myself to her having to be exposed to a scoundrel now and then, but to think that at any moment she may become involved with a fool.
Well, what are you going to do about it? Start some kind of roach campaign?
I'm going to do what she said. I'm going to have a law passed making it obligatory upon everyone to shoot any man less than 50 years old that makes, buys, sells, or thinks whiskey. Scoundrel I can face. But to think of her being exposed to any fool. He returned to town. The night was warm, the darkness filled with the sound of new-fledged cicadas. He was using a bed, one chair, a bureau on which he had spread a towel, and upon which lay his brushes, his watch, his pipe, and tobacco pouch, and propped against a book a photograph of his stepdaughter, Little Belle. Upon the glazed surface, a highlight lay. He shifted the photograph until the face came clear. He stood before it, looking at the sweet, inscrutable face, which looked in turn at something just beyond his shoulder, out of the dead cardboard. He was thinking of the grape arbor in Kinston, of summer twilight, and the murmur of voices darkening into silence as he approached. Who meant them, her, no harm. Who meant her less than harm, good God. Darkening into the pale whisper of her white dress, of the delicate and urgent mammalian whisper of that curious small flesh which he had not begot, and in which appeared to be vatted delicately some seething sympathy with the blossoming grape. He moved suddenly. As of its own accord, the photograph had shifted, slipping a little from its precarious balancing against the book. The image blurred into the highlight, like something familiar seen beneath disturbed though clear water. He looked at the familiar image with a kind of quiet horror and despair, at a face suddenly older in sin than he would ever be, a face more blurred than sweet, at eyes more secret than soft. In reaching for it, he knocked it flat, whereupon once more the face mused tenderly behind the rigid travesty of the painted mouth, contemplating something beyond his shoulder. He lay in bed, dressed, with the light burning, until he heard the courthouse clock strike 3. Then he left the house, putting his watch and his tobacco pouch into his pocket. The railroad station was 3/4 of a mile away. The waiting room was lit by a single weak bulb. It was empty, save for a man in overalls asleep on a bench, his head on his folded coat, snoring, and a woman in a calico dress, in a dingy shawl and a new hat trimmed with rigid and moribund flowers, set square and awkward on her head. Her head was bent. She may have been asleep. Her hands crossed on a paper-wrapped parcel upon her lap, a straw suitcase at her feet. It was then that Horace found that he had forgot his pipe. The train came, finding him tramping back and forth along the cinder-packed right-of-way. The man and woman got on, the man carrying his rumpled coat, the woman the parcel and the suitcase. He followed them into the day coach, filled with snoring, with bodies sprawled half into the aisle as though in the aftermath of a sudden and violent destruction, with dropped heads open-mouthed, their throats turned profoundly upward as though waiting the stroke of knives. He dozed. The train clicked on, stopped, jolted. He waked and dozed again. Someone shook him out of sleep into a primrose dawn, among unshaven, puffy faces washed lightly over, as though with the paling ultimate stain of a holocaust, blinking at one another with dead eyes into which personality returned in secret opaque waves. He got off, had breakfast, and took another accommodation, entering a car where a child wailed hopelessly, crunching peanut shells under his feet as he moved up the car in a stale ammoniac odor until he found a seat beside a man. A moment later, the man leaned forward and spat tobacco juice between his knees. Horace rose quickly and went forward into the smoking car. It was full, too, the door between it and the Jim Crow car swinging open. Standing in the aisle, he could look forward into a diminishing corridor of green plush seatbacks topped by hatted cannonballs swaying in unison, while gusts of talk and laughter blew back and kept in steady motion the blue, acrid air in which white men sat, spitting into the aisle. He changed again. The waiting crowd was composed half of young men in collegiate clothes with small cryptic badges on their shirts and vests, and two girls with painted small faces and scant bright dresses like identical artificial flowers surrounded each by bright and restless bees. When the train came, they pushed gaily forward, talking and laughing, shouldering aside older people with gay rudeness, clashing and slamming seats back and settling themselves, turning their faces up out of laughter, their cold faces still toothed with it, as three middle-aged women moved down the car, looking tentatively left and right at the filled seats. The two girls sat together, removing a fawn and a blue hat, lifting slender hands and preening not quite formless fingers about their close heads, seen between the sprawled elbows and the leaning heads of two youths hanging over the back of the seat, and surrounded by colored hat bands at various heights, where the owners sat on the seat arms or stood in the aisle. And presently the conductor's cap, as he thrust among them with plaintive, fretful cries, like a bird. "Tickets! Tickets, please!" he chanted. For an instant they held him there, invisible save for his cap. Then two young men slipped swiftly back and into the seat behind Horace. He could hear them breathing. Forward the conductor's punch clicked twice. He came on back. "Tickets!" he chanted. "Tickets!" He took Horace's and stopped where the youth sat. "You already got mine," one said. "Up there." "Where's your check?" the conductor said. "You never gave us any. You got our ticket, so. Mine was number..." He repeated a number glibly in a frank, pleasant tone. "Did you notice the number of your shack?" The second one repeated a number in a frank, pleasant tone. "Sure, you got ours. Look and see." He began to whistle between his teeth, a broken dance rhythm. Unmusical. "Do you eat at Gordon Hall?" the other said. "No, I have natural halitosis," the conductor went on. The whistle reached crescendo, clapped off by his hands on his knees, ejaculating, "Da-da-da." Then he just squalled, meaningless, vertiginous. To Horace, it was like sitting before a series of printed pages turned in furious snatches, leaving a series of cryptic, headless, and tailless evocations on the mind. "She's traveled 1,000 miles without a ticket.
Marge, too.
Beth, too.
Da-da-da.
Marge, too.
I'm going to punch mine Friday night.
E-yow.
Do you like liver?
I can't reach that far. E-yow!"
They whistled, clapping their heels on the floor to furious crescendo, saying, "Da-da-da!" The first jolted the seat back against Horace's head. He rose. "Come on," he said. "He's done gone." Again the seat jarred into Horace, and he watched them return and join the group that blocked the aisle. Saw one of them lay his bold, rough hand flat upon one of the bright, soft faces up-tilted to them. Beyond the group, a countrywoman with an infant in her arms stood, braced against a seat. From time to time she looked back at the blocked aisle and the empty seats beyond. At Oxford, he descended into a throng of them at the station, hatless, in bright dresses, now and then with books in their hands, and surrounded still by swarms of colored shirts. Impassible, swinging hands with their escorts, objects of casual and puppyish pawings, they dawdled up the hill toward the college, swinging their little hips, looking at Horace with cold, blank eyes as he stepped off the walk in order to pass them. At the top of the hill, three paths diverged through a broad grove, beyond which in green vistas buildings in red brick or gray stone gleamed, and where a clear soprano bell began to ring. The procession became three streams, thinning rapidly upon the dawdling couple's swinging hands, strolling in erratic surges, lurching into one another with puppyish squeals, with the random, intense purposelessness of children. The broader path led to the post office. He entered and waited until the window was clear. "I'm trying to find a young lady, Miss Temple Drake. I probably just missed her, didn't I?"
"She's not here any longer," the clerk said. "She quit school about 2 weeks ago."
He was young, a dull, smooth face behind horn glasses, the hair meticulous. After a time, Horace heard himself asking quietly, "You don't know where she went?" The clerk looked at him. He leaned, lowering his voice.
"Are you another detective?"
"Yes," Horace said. "Yes. No matter. It doesn't matter." Then he was walking quietly down the steps into the sunlight again. He stood there, while on both sides of him they passed in a steady stream of little colored dresses, bare-armed, with close, bright heads, with that identical, cool, innocent, unabashed expression which he knew well in their eyes, above the savage, identical paint upon their mouths, like music moving, like honey poured in sunlight, pagan and evanescent and serene, thinly evocative of all lost days and outpaced delights in the sun. Bright, trembling with heat, it lay in open glades of mirage-like glimpses of stone or brick, columns without tops, towers apparently floating above a green cloud in slow ruin against the southwest wind, sinister, imponderable, bland. And he, standing there listening to the sweet cloistral bell, thinking, "Now what? What now?" And answering himself, "Why, nothing. Nothing. It's finished." He returned to the station an hour before the train was due, a filled but unlighted cob pipe in his hand. In the lavatory he saw, scrawled on the foul-stained wall, her penciled name. "Temple Drake." He read it quietly, his head bent, slowly fingering the unlighted pipe. A half hour before the train came, they began to gather, strolling down the hill and gathering along the platform with thin, bright, raucous laughter, their blonde legs monotonous, their bodies moving continually inside their scant garments, with that awkward and voluptuous purposelessness of the young. The return train carried a Pullman. He went on through the day coach and entered it. There was only one other occupant, a man in the center of the car, next the window, bareheaded, leaning back, his elbow on the window sill and an unlighted cigar in his ringed hand. When the train drew away, passing the sleek crowns in increasing reverse,
The other passenger rose and went forward toward the day coach. He carried an overcoat on his arm and a soiled, light-colored felt hat. With the corner of his eye, Horace saw his hand fumbling at his breast pocket, and he remarked the severe trim of hair across the man's vast, soft, white neck. Like with a guillotine, Horace thought, watching the man sidle past the porter in the aisle and vanish, passing out of his sight and his mind in the act of flinging the hat onto his head. The train sped on, swaying on the curves, flashing past an occasional house, through cuts and across valleys where young cotton wheeled slowly in fan-like rows. The train checked speed. A jerk came back, and four whistle blasts. The man in the soiled hat entered, taking a cigar from his breast pocket. He came down the aisle swiftly, looking at Horace. He slowed, the cigar in his fingers. The train jolted again. The man flung his hand out and caught the back of the seat facing Horace.
"Ain't this Judge Benbow?" he said.
Horace looked up into a vast, puffy face without any mark of age or thought whatever, a majestic sweep of flesh on either side of a small, blunt nose, like looking out over a mesa, yet withal some indefinable quality of delicate paradox, as though the Creator had completed his joke by lighting the munificent expenditure of putty with something originally intended for some weak, acquisitive creature like a squirrel or a rat.
"Don't I address Judge Benbow?" he said, offering his hand. "I'm Senator Snopes, Clarence Snopes."
"Oh," Horace said. "Yes, thanks," he said. "But I'm afraid you anticipate a little. Hope, rather." The other waved the cigar, the other hand palm up, the third finger discolored faintly at the base of a huge ring in Horace's face. Horace shook it and freed his hand.
"I thought I recognized you when you got on at Oxford," Snopes said. "But I... May I sit down?" he said, already shoving at Horace's knee with his leg.
He flung the overcoat, a shoddy blue garment with a greasy velvet collar, on the seat and sat down as the train stopped.
"Yes, sir. I'm always glad to see any of the boys anytime."
He leaned across Horace and peered out the window at a small, dingy station with its cryptic bulletin board chalked over, an express truck bearing a wire chicken coop containing two forlorn fowls, at three or four men in overalls gone restfully against the wall, chewing.
"Course you ain't in my county no longer, but what I say a man's friends is his friends, whichever way they vote. Because a friend is a friend, and whether he can do anything for me or not."
He leaned back, the unlighted cigar in his fingers.
"You ain't come all the way up from the big town, then?"
"No," Horace said.
"Anytime you're in Jackson, I'll be glad to accommodate you as if you was still in my county. Don't no man stay so busy he ain't got time for his own friends, what I say. Let's see. You're in Kinston now, ain't you? I know your senators, fine men, both of them. But I just can't call their names."
"I really couldn't say myself," Horace said. The train started. Snopes leaned into the aisle, looking back. His light gray suit had been pressed, but not cleaned.
"Well," he said.
He rose and took up the overcoat.
"Anytime you're in the city. You going to Jefferson, I reckon?"
"Yes," Horace said.
"I'll see you again, then."
"Why not ride back here?" Horace said. "You'll find it more comfortable."
"I'm going up and have a smoke," Snopes said, waving the cigar. "I'll see you again."
"You can smoke here. There aren't any ladies."
"Sure," Snopes said. "I'll see you at Holly Springs."
He went on back toward the day coach and passed out of sight with a cigar in his mouth. Horace remembered him 10 years ago as a hulking, dull youth, son of a restaurant owner, member of a family which had been moving from the Frenchman's Bend neighborhood into Jefferson for the past 20 years in sections. a family of enough ramifications to have elected him to the legislature without recourse to a public polling. He sat quite still, the cold pipe in his hand. He rose and went forward through the day coach, then into the smoker. Snopes was in the aisle, his thigh draped over the arm of a seat where four men sat, using the unlighted cigar to gesture with. Horace caught his eye and beckoned from the vestibule. A moment later, Snopes joined him, the overcoat on his arm. "How are things going at the Capitol?" Horace said. Snopes began to speak in his harsh, assertive voice. There emerged gradually a picture of stupid chicanery and petty corruption for stupid and petty ends, conducted principally in hotel rooms into which bellboys whisked with bulging jackets upon discreet flicks of skirts in swift closet doors.
"Any time you're in town," he said, "I always like to show the boys around. Ask anybody in town. They'll tell you. If it's there, Clarence Snopes'll know where it is. You got a pretty tough case up home now, what I hear."
"Can't tell yet," Horace said. He said, "I stopped off at Oxford today, at the university, speaking to some of my stepdaughter's friends. One of her best friends is no longer in school there, a young lady from Jackson named Temple Drake." Snopes was watching him with thick, small, opaque eyes.
"Oh, yeah, Judge Drake's gal," he said. "The one that ran away."
"Ran away," Horace said. "Ran back home, did she? What was the trouble? Fail in her work?"
"I don't know. When it come out in the paper, folks thought she'd run off with some fella. One of them companionate marriages."
"But when she turned up at home, they knew it wasn't that, I reckon."
"Well, well, Belle'll be surprised. What's she doing now? Running around Jackson, I suppose." "She ain't there."
"Not?" Horace said. He could feel the other watching him. "Where is she?"
"Her pa sent her up north somewhere with an aunt. Michigan. Was in the papers a couple days later."
"Oh," Horace said. He still held the cold pipe, and he discovered his hand searching his pocket for a match. He drew a deep breath. "That Jackson paper's a pretty good paper. It's considered the most reliable paper in the state, isn't it?"
"Sure," Snopes said. "You was at Oxford trying to locate her?"
"No, no, I just happened to meet a friend of my daughter who told me she had left school." "Well, I'll see you at Holly Springs."
"Sure," Snopes said.
Horace returned to the Pullman and sat down and lit the pipe. When the train slowed for Holly Springs, he went to the vestibule. Then he stepped quickly back into the car. Snopes emerged from the day coach as the porter opened the door and swung down the step, stool in hand. Snopes descended. He took something from his breast pocket and gave it to the porter.
"Here, George," he said. "Have a cigar."
Horace descended. Snopes went on, the soiled hat towering half a head above any other. Horace looked at the porter. "He gave it to you, did he?" The porter chucked the cigar on his palm. He put it in his pocket. "What are you going to do with it?" Horace said.
"I wouldn't give it to nobody I know," the porter said.
"Does he do this very often?"
3-4 times a year.
Seems like I always get him, too. Thanks, sir." Horace saw Snopes enter the waiting room. The soiled hat, the vast neck, passed again out of his mind. He filled the pipe again. From a block away, he heard the Memphis-bound train come in. It was at the platform when he reached the station. Beside the open vestibule, Snopes stood, talking with two youths in new straw hats, with something vaguely mentorial about his thick shoulders and his gestures. The train whistled. The two youths got on,
Horace stepped back around the corner of the station. When his train came, he saw Snopes get on ahead of him and enter the smoker. Horace knocked out his pipe and entered the day coach and found a seat at the rear facing backward.